is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Richard Dawkins has done it again. He's taken the gloves off and come out with a new book, this time directly on Christianity. And that's what makes this just a little bit different. In previous writings, he has taken on the issue all the way from the selfish gene forward. He is the leading evangelist for evolutionary theory in the world today, the Charles Simonyi Professor of Science at Oxford University. His new book is entitled The God Delusion, and what makes it really interesting is that it's a 400-page attack upon belief in God. I wrote a major review of the book at Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com. You've got time, as we go through some issues in the news, to take a look at that and get an idea of the book yourself and to get ready to give us a call at 877-893-8255. The big question is this: what do we make of this kind of sustained and continuing attack upon the Christian faith? Three recent books out, one by Sam Harris, one by Daniel Dennett, now this one by Richard Dawkins, and there are more on the way. What do we do with this? You know, 300 years after the Enlightenment, what does this represent for us? And the next question is, how do we answer a Richard Dawkins? We're going to be talking about this on today's edition of the Albert Mohler Program. To call, the number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Folks, you know, if you get certain people in a room, you know, just the proverbial joke, you know, if you were to take, for instance, a Jew, a Christian, and a Muslim and put them in a room, you know, it's like the old line, they walk into a bar or whatever. And, you know, here's the deal. So long as they are tepid, compromising, moderate, whatever believers in whatever they say they are, they can get along just swimmingly. The problem is if they are actual believers, ardent Orthodox believers, genuine convictional believers, in the actual truth claims of these faith systems, these belief systems, these worldviews. In other words, of course, at one level, we can get together and get along in society in terms of politeness and social etiquette and all the rest. We can even agree that there's certain social and cultural aims to which we should direct ourselves. We can agree that we need laws that would protect, for instance, against murder and theft and embezzlement and dishonesty and things like that. That all makes sense. But the moment we begin to talk about the specific beliefs of our deepest faith in God, then we're going to find that there are some very hard corners. There are some very intractable issues. Now, USA Today yesterday had a very interesting article by Kathy Lynn Grossman, and she is one of the best religion reporters out there. She has a very keen eye and ear for what's going on. And the title of this article published yesterday is Three Moms, Three Faiths, One Book. And it has to do with the fact that there are these three moms representing Christianity, Judaism, and Islam who have decided they're going to write a book about, how open-minded they are. The book is entitled The Faith Club. It includes Randa Elabi, a Muslim, Suzanne Oliver, a Christian, and Priscilla Warner, a Jew. According to USA Today, this New York City trio is out to share with a fractious world their way of fostering interreligious understanding soul to soul. Now, this is the kind of thing that's almost, it's tailor-made for Oprah. I mean, this is talk show television stuff right here. You got the three moms, Muslim, Christian, Jew, who get together and talk about the fact that they get together so well because they're open-minded and now they've written a book. They gather in Oliver's apartment to talk about their experience. They're easy, laughing, finishing one another's thoughts and bolstering one another's ideas, munching their favorite snacks, such as Warner's addictive gourmet chocolates. But the Faith Club, this is the book, reveals how very hard it was when they were spiritual strangers, learning to lay down their guards and dredge up their deepest fears and prejudices. Through it all, they found insight into one another's beliefs and greater clarity in their own. They met back in 2002, reeling after the 9/11 attacks, trying to figure these things out. They started a dialogue. They read together a children's book, and it says here that they wrote together a children's book. They were then challenged by the publisher to write something more substantial, and the Faith Club, that's the name of the book, is what came out. That's what they call themselves. Now, what's really, really interesting is they admit that the only way this works is because they're not particularly scrupulous believers in their own belief system. They talk about how they achieve spiritual intimacy in the Faith Club. Ms. Warner says, once we began exchanging vulnerabilities, there was no going back. Over time, they met, wrote letters, emailed, or called each other so that they came to hear one another's voices in their heads. Listen to this. I knew, Idlibby says, if I couldn't present myself as a Muslim in this group, there's no hope for me outside it. She's angry that the media focuses on the most fundamentalist side of Islam instead of the full spectrum of ways to believe in and practice the faith. She wants to shout out, how dare you? Don't tell me that's Islam. Nowhere in the Quran does it say kill and you'll be rewarded. Through the Faith Club, Idlibby says, she has found a way to speak out about plurality, diversity, and flexibility among Muslim believers, just as there is among Christians and Jews. Now, what's really, really interesting, again, is that there is a very explicit statement here that this has to work only if, it can work only if, you're talking about people who are basically more liberal in terms of their stance toward their own belief system. Listen to this. There are stumbling blocks, however. Will everyone be as open, as bold, as willing to press on with these women's mantra of absolute honesty, constantly asking one another, what do you really think? This is USA Today, Kathy Lynn Grossman. Here's the next paragraph. For anyone who reads the Quran or the Bible literally, rather than metaphorically or in a cultural context, the women say their views will be too liberal. For people who believe there's exactly one way to heaven, described and delineated only by their own faith, the Faith Club may not offer a template. Now, that just brings me face to face with what the modern age and now this new postmodern mood has done to questions of truth. We can say that truth is important to us as meaning so long as it doesn't have to be important to us as truth. We can transform everything into how we feel, and we can take away any propositional truth claim and leave it just as, well, you know, the way I describe this reality is A, you describe it as B, you describe it as C, but what do we know anyway? But let's just get back to the basic, rock-hard, concrete fact that the Christian truth claim is inherently propositional. It is inherently making claims that are at odds with other claims. Jesus himself left us no room for any misunderstanding about this. When Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no man comes unto the Father but by me, he was not saying this like he was speaking some kind of Hallmark card ritual that he was hoping is, you know, just to give a little motto to his disciples. He was saying, look, this is the decisive issue of belief. You will either believe in me or you will not. But believing in me is the only way you can come to the Father. And by the way, you know, it doesn't start there. Even in John chapter 3, you know, Christians love, appropriately love, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him might not perish, but have everlasting life. But they often do not think of the end of John chapter 3. Because the end of John chapter 3 is one of the clearest statements of the exclusivity of the gospel of Christ that is found anywhere in Scripture. Let's just go to the end of John chapter 3. John says this, the Father loves the Son and has given all things to him. He who believes in the Son has eternal life, but he who does not obey the Son will not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him. And you know, that's even harder to get around than what Jesus said, in the sense that this is at the very beginning of the gospel. It's declared, even at the beginning of the gospel, as the way we're supposed to understand everything that follows. So John has told us here that this issue is not something that can be negotiated away over coffee in a New York apartment. The Faith Club is a symbol of our times. And, you know, here is the deal. People are saying, in the aftermath of 9/11, in a dangerous world where people with all kinds of beliefs are rubbing up against each other, just given the brute fact of religious diversity, we need to learn how to talk to each other. Well, yes, we do need to learn how to talk to each other. But we need to learn how to talk to each other as genuine Christians. I can respect my conversation with a Muslim who is genuinely a Muslim. It does me no good whatsoever to talk to a Muslim who claims to be Muslim, who doesn't believe in the central tenets of Islam. Yes, let's be in conversation with our Jewish neighbors, but let's hope they actually represent Judaism. Because otherwise, it's just kind of a tag we put on ourselves like we're members of a club. But when it comes to issues of belief in God, it's not about a club. It's about a system of beliefs. That system of beliefs either does or does not line up with the reality of who God is and what he expects of us and what provision he has made for our salvation. When you lay out Judaism and Islam and Christianity, yes, there are many common elements we could talk about. All three understand that God has revealed himself in a book. All three understand that human sin is a significant problem. All three are, in a very clear sense, monotheistic. But when it comes right down to it, we're not even talking about the same God. Just because we agree that the number is one doesn't mean that we're talking about the same one God. Because for Christians, we are told that if we have seen Christ, we've seen the Father. He who does not have the Son has no life in him. Now, that might not make for the best coffee clutch, but you know what? On that truth, eternity hangs. The Faith Club. That's a pretty good foreground for us to talk about the God delusion. Richard Dawkins says, all this is nonsense anyway, because there's no God in whom to believe. The phone number is 877-893-8255, and the time is for intelligent Christian conversation about this new book. And we'll be right back. You know, there are some people in the world who seem to get an inordinate amount of attention. Richard Dawkins is one of those. And part of it is because he's one of those scientists who's also a very good communicator. He really is. He's the kind of communicator who gets media attention because he knows how to talk in the media. You know, if you ask the average scientist, no insult to scientists here, that's why you're so good in the laboratory. But you ask the average scientist, you know, a public policy question, and you get a very long answer that doesn't fit a media context. You ask Richard Dawkins, and you're going to get a soundbite, and that soundbite is going to have venom in it. It's going to have barbs in it. It's like a stiletto when he speaks. And this is a man who thinks that belief in God is one of the most dangerous elements of the modern world. In The God Delusion, he's really picking up on arguments that he's been making throughout his writing history. He is criticized, by the way, by some scientists who consider themselves a bit more serious in terms of their writing for the fact that, after all, we're talking about his books. I mean, there are a lot of scientists who think that success is the average person on the street having no idea they've written the book, but the people in the guild and the academic world thinking it's the greatest thing since the splitting of the atom. But this is a man who writes popular books, and he has written quite a few. This is a man who, by the way, is very wealthy off of his books, and he's going to get wealthy off of this one because it's going to sell. It's entitled The God Delusion, published by Houghton Mifflin, major publisher, big publicity campaign. I have written a full review of this book at my website at Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com. Now, let's just set the stage for a little bit of what we're talking about here. Now, he's saying that belief in God is not only baseless, that is, without merit, but it is also explained by evolution. This is a man who believes so much in evolution. He is so committed to evolutionary theory that he's absolutely convinced that the very fact that human beings believe in God is an accident of the evolutionary process. He also thinks it's not a thing unto itself. It's a byproduct of something else. Interestingly, here's one of the things he believes. Now, follow this. He says, look, species that have children who accept what the parents say on authority are more likely to survive than species who have children who do not take on faith what their parents teach. Well, it's kind of like don't run out in the road. In other words, the species, and I guess what makes this so fascinating to me as one who doesn't believe in evolution is, where are all the species that evidently had the kids that did get run over in the street? I mean, that's a part of this whole picture that is missing. But he says an evolutionary advantage is in children being ready to take on authority what their parents teach. And so you kind of take that writ large in a society, and that's where religion comes from. He's talking about it. It's because there's an authority that's brought in behind the parent. So that this authority, who's the speaking God who says, you obey me, you child, I'm a parent, that this God is behind becomes an imaginary figment of belief that nonetheless serves to help children obey what their parents say and take on faith what needs to be taken on faith. And it adds meaning in terms of the cultural system such that it's brought together in such things as wedding ceremonies and what happens at funerals and all the rest. And he says there's an evolutionary advantage to this. But he also is very clear that he thinks whatever evolutionary advantage there once was to belief in God, it's long gone. This is an audacious man. He knows he's an audacious man. In the opening pages of his book, he says, look, my hope in this, listen to this. He says, if this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down. Now, you know, this is really fascinating. You know, I've got a book coming out in the next few weeks, and I've got an ambition for it. I hope people read it, and I hope it helps to change their minds. I hope it helps to reach their hearts. But you know what? I think it's incredibly audacious to write a book and say, I hope that people who pick up this book who are religious believers will be atheists when they put it down. But he knows it's audacious. He goes on and says that. He says, what presumptuous optimism. But hey, this is what he's doing. This is where he's going. He's been in the media already in Great Britain talking about this. He was interviewed by one of the most fascinating journalists in Great Britain, Jeremy Paxman. And let's just listen to what he had to say about his audacity in writing this book.
Well, your ambition, I suppose, is that people reading this book abandon any sense of belief in a deity.
That's an absurdly ambitious ambition. It is my ambition. I don't see any harm in aiming high. I'm aware that there are a large number of dyed-in-the-wool faceheads who will never be changed, but I think there's a big middle ground of people who actually haven't thought about it very much, who think of themselves as religious, but haven't given it very much thought, and I really hope they might be changed.
That was just worth listening to those accents, wasn't it? I mean, there you have Jeremy Paxman talking about deity. And you have Richard Dawkins coming back. By the way, Jeremy Paxman is one who writes a great deal about Great Britain. And when it comes, for instance, to the Church of England, he says, look, you know, it's not serious about God. It's just it's serious about, well, smells and bells. It's not really serious about beliefs, but it is really serious about etiquette, and it's very serious about vestments. And so I think he's pretty much nailed the cultural context there. But Richard Dawkins isn't worried about all that. He's really not. He's not worried about, you know, the priest going around wearing the vestments, and he's not worried about the incense burning in the altar. He's worried about people who actually believe in God. That's what worries him. Because he says, this is dangerous. These people are dangerous because, number one, they are backward. And listen to what he says here. He says, religion is so wasteful, so extravagant. And that's the way he sees it. He sees religion as something that is really dangerous because it leads to violence and many other things because people take on these beliefs and then are ready to fight for them. He also thinks that Christianity in particular is odious. Listen to what he says about the Christian doctrine of atonement. He says, I have described atonement, the central doctrine of Christianity, as vicious, sadomasochistic, and repellent. We should also dismiss it as barking mad, but for its ubiquitous familiarity, which has dulled our objectivity. Now, by the way, he wants to get rid of the Ten Commandments because there's no God to speak the Ten Commandments. There's no smoke and mountain on there's no smoke and thunder on the mountain. Instead, it's just an artifact of our religious evolution as a people. So he wants to get rid of the Ten Commandments, and he's got some new ones he wants to suggest. The new commandments. Here's one of them: enjoy your own sex life so long as it damages nobody else, and leave others to enjoy theirs in private, whatever their inclinations, which is none of your business. Okay, there's one of his commandments. Another one, you're going to love this one. Do not discriminate or oppress on the basis of sex, race, or as far as possible, species, end quote. Now, I love that last part, as far as possible, species. I guess what he means is it's still okay for us to eat the animals rather than for them to eat us, but only maybe partially okay, because when, insofar as it's possible, we don't discriminate. We shouldn't discriminate on species basis either, on the basis of species. Another one of his commandments hits very close to home. He says, quote, do not indoctrinate your children. Teach them how to think for themselves, how to evaluate evidence, and how to disagree with you, end quote. Let me ask you a question. I don't even know if Richard Dawkins has kids, but what if one of them turned out to be an evangelist? I mean, if he really is teaching his kids to think objectively and not to follow his own way of thinking, he's taking a risk here. You see, I don't think people mean that. I don't think anybody means that. I don't think there's a parent on the earth that really doesn't care how his or her children turn out in terms of belief system. And when the secularist says, I just wanted to have an open mind, you know what? I say, that is simply ridiculous. If they come home wearing a burqa, you're not going to be so hot for the open mind. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Let me end with this as we kind of open our discussion. There is a long line of skeptics, of the enemies of the Christian faith, that have offered their philosophies and written their books. The truth is that the intellectual elite is very frustrated. They can't figure out why belief in God is so persistent. After all, they were prophesying 200 years ago, in the aftermath of the Enlightenment, that it would pass away and quickly. The Victorians were sure that they were the last to see an age of faith, and yet the majority of Americans still say they believe in God. A majority identify with Christianity. And you go around the world, and the majority of people are not atheists. You know, that leads Richard Dawkins to scratch his head, but it also led him to write a book, a 400-page diatribe against belief in God. Now, here's what I think. I think if you think the belief in God is passing, you don't have to write a 400-page book. There's more going on here than meets the eye. Join the conversation by calling 877-893-8255. Is belief in God a delusion? We'll be right back.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about The God Delusion. That's the latest book by Richard Dawkins, Oxford University scientist. He's the author of The Selfish Gene, several other books that really have garnered a lot of attention. And it's because he is a very fine writer. He's able to make a point, and he's able to sustain an argument. By the way, I want to say something just as a matter of record. Some of the arguments that he attacks in this book, some of the arguments put forth by Christians, in defense of belief in God, he skewers hard, and he skewers appropriately some of them that just aren't very good arguments. For instance, Christians should not use arguments about probability when it comes to belief in God. I mean, we're not talking about belief in God because of math. I also would suggest to you that what is known historically as Pascal's wager is not a good argument for faith in God. Pascal, a philosopher of some time past now, who made the argument that it would be better to believe in God and find out you're wrong than not to believe in God and find out you're wrong. And you know, that's just a bad argument. We're not rolling the dice here and saying, what are the better odds? There are some other bad arguments. There's some bad arguments we use for different things, such as against abortion. Some of you may have heard this story about, would you abort under this circumstance? He was born into a child of a family of seven children. He was the eighth child. The mother was sick. The father was dead. You go all the way down, and then they say, well, you would have aborted Beethoven. The problem is somebody made that up. It's not even true. And we as Christians should be embarrassed whenever an argument we make turns out to be either illogical and fallacious or just based even worse in a falsehood. We set ourselves up for the very kind of critique that Richard Dawkins wants to present. But once we understand that there are some false arguments and some bad arguments and some fallacious arguments that we ought not to make, we're left with making the central argument for the truth claim of Christianity. And, we come back to the fact that the basic argument here has to do with, at one level, the observation of the natural world and the fact that it's just incredible, literally incredible, lacking in credibility, I believe, to look at this and see it as a great cosmic accident. And more than that, the God in whom we believe is not a silent God. He is there, and he has spoken. And thus we have his self-revelation concerning the world and ourselves and all things that are important of importance for our understanding of eternity. But when you look at Richard Dawkins, you're looking at you're looking at an enemy worth having. You know, this is something that also deserves to be said. The Christian faith has attracted some of the most significant enemies in the history of the world. I mean, just think about it. Just think of the last 250 years, the enemies of Christianity, enemies such as Mao, enemies such as Stalin, enemies such as Marx, enemies such as Freud, enemies such as Darwin, when Darwin very clearly understood that his belief means the unraveling of the basic structure of theism. We've also had some philosophical enemies, Bertrand Russell. We've had some great atheistic enemies. I can respect those persons better than the kind of postmodern, whatever, smug kind of response you get from a lot of people. For instance, you walk on a college campus today, you say, do you believe in God? Whatever. You know, why do you believe in God or not believe in God? I don't know. Against that postmodern relativism, frankly, it kind of dignifies the Christian faith to know that it can have real enemies. And Richard Dawkins is just, well, perhaps one of the latest of those. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. If you're ready to talk about this, it's at two levels. Number one, what does it say that a man holding one of the most illustrious chairs in science in Oxford University thinks he's supposed to write this book, that he needs to write this book, in order to try to convince persons not to believe in God? And then secondly, how would you answer him? Richard Dawkins, he's not going to show up at your doorstep, but he's going to show up on your television screen. What are you going to say to him? Well, when you look at Richard Dawkins, You're looking at someone who also has personality, and that comes out in his answer to questions. Let's listen to another clip. This is from his interview with Jeremy Paxman from the BBC Radio. The program is Newsnight Book Club. The recording quality is not all that good, but hey, it's what we could get in terms of you hearing this man's voice, and you need to hear him for yourself.
Professor Dawkins, why are you so wound up about the position of faith in our society?
I'm wound up about the truth. I care passionately about the truth as a scientist, and I do regard religious claims about the universe as alternative scientific claims. So the claim that the universe contains a God, contains a creative intelligence, is a scientific claim, because the universe would be a very different kind of universe with such a being than without it.
Well, if you were listening to what he said there, he's basically saying, look, here are two scientific claims. Scientific claim number one, there is a God. Scientific claim number two, there is not a God. And the only way to deal with these is science. You know, one of the things we have here is a man who privileges the knowledge system of science more than anything else. And in his view, there's no other way to know anything. Now, that's really interesting, isn't it? I wonder what his view of marriage is. We'll be right back. You know, here's another thesis I'm going to put out there just for your discussion and thinking. I don't think you're going to hear this from your neighbor. I mean, I don't think many of us have neighbors that are sitting around being hardline evolutionary naturalists and materialists. I think most of them are more likely to be, you know, soft somethings. You know, they're going to claim some kind of belief in something, confused though they may be. I tell you where you are going to find this. You land on the university campus, you're going to find this. You send your kid to the university campus. He, she is going to find this. You go to New York City, you go to the major intellectual capitals of the world, and you go to the people who are the elites in the publishing and commercial and business and other worlds, you're going to find this. How do we answer this? That's the big question. The phone number, 877-893-8255. What do we do with this? What do we do with the fact that an Oxford University professor has written a 400-page attack upon Christianity? I mean, after all, it's not like this attack's really new. The newness of it, though, is that he grounds it entirely in an evolutionary understanding. I mean, this is a guy who is, well, he's been called Darwin's Rottweiler, and he's living up to his name. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Mark, listening on XM170, calling from Cincinnati. Go ahead, Mark.
I just thought it was an excellent comment that you made regarding the enemies of Christianity, and I guess I never would have thought about it this way, but it really does kind of force us and allow us to really examine our beliefs and learn how to talk in this kind of oppressive and very hostile kind of culture.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, Mark. Let me ask you to tease that out just a little bit. How important do you think it is for Christians to actually take these arguments seriously? Is it a waste of time for us to look at a book like this? Should we just write it off? There's an enemy of Christianity spouting off. Let's just ignore him. Or should we take a pretty good look at this in order to make sure we have an answer?
I think we ought to really seriously consider what he's talking about, because he's likely not the only person that thinks this way. You know, our next door neighbor could potentially be have the same kind of viewpoints, and
or certainly and, be you know, influenced God, by it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, as I said, certainly could be influenced by it. I mean, whether our next door neighbor is ready to sound like Richard Dawkins, there probably aren't too many of those. But I think we have a lot of next door neighbors that are ready to hear him on the talk radio or to read his book and perhaps be confused or seduced by the ideas. I think that's a very good point. Mark, thanks so much for calling. I appreciate your call. And I think you're exactly right. I think we as Christians have to take these arguments seriously. I mean, otherwise, what are we afraid of? Are we afraid that we really don't hold the truth? Are we afraid that we really can't know the truth? Are we afraid that if we look at a book like this, well, are we afraid that Richard Dawkins just might be right? That if we pick up this 400-page book, will begin as a God believer and end as an atheist? I got to tell you this. If your faith in God is such that reading Richard Dawkins' book, you lose it, then you really didn't have it in the first place. But I do think there are a lot of people out there who have this kind of soft, vague, kind of generalized understanding about belief in God, some amorphous deity, some vague spirituality. They read this book, and they're going to have a very hard time. You know, there are really only two alternatives. How many times do we come back to this? There are really only two alternatives. You believe in the God of the Bible, or you head into some kind of nihilism, belief in nothing. Because there really isn't any kind of middle ground that holds very well. And Richard Dawkins understands that. It's very interesting, by the way. He comes to the end of his book and he says, look, once we get rid of belief in God, we can still keep some of the traditions. We can still keep some of the ceremonies. We can still hold weddings. You know, it doesn't, we're not calling God as a witness to the marriage of these two people. We're not going to say it was instituted by God, but we can still have weddings and throw rice and dress up and all the rest. We can still have funerals. But you know, what do you say? What in the world do you say? If that's the funeral, and you are yourself an atheist, if you're following his example, then what in the world are you going to say at the very end of all of this? Let's listen to what he says about the purpose of our existence. Here again, Richard Dawkins.
When you hear, for example, today on the day of the Jewish New Year, you hear the chief rabbi on the radio this morning talking about how there is a purpose to our existence. What do you think?
Well, in one sense, there is a purpose to our existence, which is the propagation of DNA. But that's not a very uplifting purpose. It's not the kind of purpose he means. I think there's a purpose to each individual's existence, which is a purpose that we make for ourselves. And you make your own purposes, I make my own purposes. That's different from the kind of purpose to existence, which somebody like the chief rabbi means.
Okay, Richard Dawkins sometimes nails Christians for bad arguments. And we need to know those bad arguments, and we need to stop making them. But you know what? What he just said there is an empty answer. Jeremy Paxton said to him, what's the meaning of life? Is it just the replication of genes? And he came back and said, no, it's got to be a little bit more than that. He came back and said, no, it means the existence we make for ourselves. Well, you know what? How many of you feel like you can make an existence for yourself? How many of you feel like you can conjure up meaning in your life that's really going to keep you alive, that's going to keep you going in the dark moments of life, when you know you're just making it up? And when you're staring at the hole in the ground, that's when it's just all over. You made it up, and now it's gone, and it's nothing more than replicating genes. Let's go to BJ calling from Pagosa Springs, Colorado. Go ahead, BJ.
Hey, I was just wanting to answer your question. I think that we need to take a stand. I think that we need to study this. I mean, we believe that God's word is absolute truth, and I believe that he has stuff to say about every single thing that this man's talking about in his book, and that we need to be able to find what God says about it and be able to stand as a generation that doesn't just share the Bible, but shares how the Bible is applicable to today.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point, BJ. I think you're right to say exactly what you said, and that is that we know what we know not because we're real smart people, and it's not because we looked into a microscope and found it. It's because we believe that the one true and living God is spoken in a book, and that really is an audacious claim. Maybe that's our audacious claim to put over against Richard Dawkins' audacious claim. He claims that life is nothing more than the replication of genes. It's a cosmological accident that just, well, just happened. But it happens through a process of natural selection that there is an ongoing diversification of the species, some coming into being, some passing out. This natural selection, he says, is the great miracle. It is the engine of the replication of genes with, he calls it a selfish gene. He says that the gene's purpose is to replicate itself. That's his view of life. We have to come back and say, no, and here's our audacious claim. We were created in the image of our Creator, who had a purposeful and meaningful and glorious reason for creating the world. He made us in his image. He made us moral creatures. The meaning of our life is found in the fact that we come to know ourselves as sinners. And then the big question is what we do about that. God's provision in Christ is that we can have our sins forgiven in Christ. And we also have an eschatology, a view of the end of the world, where we are told that this Creator who made the world will fully accomplish his purpose in the end. Now let me ask you, which one is the delusion? They can't both be right. It's Christianity or Richard Dawkins. You can't have both. We'll be right back. Before we go, I want you to hear this final selection in the BBC interview with Richard Dawkins. We'll be right back. Listen to this.
So what is the Bible?
It's a collection of documents written by people in the first millennium BC, like any other tribal mythology attempting to make sense of the world. All tribes have them. They're all different. This happens to be the Jewish one.
And the New Testament?
The New Testament is a modification which has come to us because of the invention of Christianity by St. Paul in the first century.
And accounts of the miracles are nonsense, are they?
Surely, yes. I mean,
the virgin birth?
Yes.
The resurrection?
If you look at any of those, any religions that were about at the same time, all those stories are duplicated many times throughout the ancient world. These are very, very common myths.
Okay, now what I find very fascinating in there, what finds me scratching my head now, is the fact that those same arguments that you just heard from Richard Dawkins have been made routinely over the last 250 years. Virtually every skeptic of Christianity has been putting forth the same kind of argument. You know, there are all kinds of texts, there are all kinds of words, there are all kinds of laws, there are claims of miracles, there are all kinds of things, and all of them are baseless. You just hear this over and over again. These things just don't happen in a natural world. It must be frustrating to a Richard Dawkins to know that what he's saying in this book is basically what's been said for the last 250 years, and they're not making much headway. Now, Richard Dawkins is a man who does not waste his time. He evidently considers this to be of primary importance. He's given a great deal of his time and energy to writing a 400-page attack on belief in God in general and Christianity in particular. I think it is because, again, the intellectual elites are very, very confused and frustrated over the persistence of belief in God. But I think there's something else. It has to bother them when they know that the vast majority of the people who surround them actually believe in God. And, you know, there is this nagging question. It has to be on their minds. What if those people are right? You see, here's one of the big problems with Richard Dawkins. Science can tell us a great deal. The scientific method is a wonderful way of coming to know reality in certain ways, in certain realities. You see, I fundamentally don't believe that the scientific method can ever fully explain why a mother loves her child. I don't think that a scientific worldview alone can explain altruism and love. I don't think that a scientific explanation alone can explain Mozart. And I'm certain that a scientific explanation alone can't explain God nor belief in Him. And if we trust in science alone, we're going to come up with an empty bag of answers. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.